This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal hayyul qayyum. La ta'khudhuhu sinatun wa la nawm. Lahu ma fis samawati wa ma من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iraq reiterates that U.S. combat forces are no more needed as the two sides are reportedly expected to agree on their withdrawal by the end of 2021. The U.S. imposes sanctions on Cuba's defense minister over the recent protests there. Havana says Washington has, quote, no legal, political or moral authority to sanction people. Also ahead, Ecuador declares a state of emergency after riots at two prisons left over 20 dead and dozens wounded. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein says his country doesn't need any more U.S. combat troops as it has its own fighters. Hussein made the comment in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kadhimi also emphasized American combat troops should leave his country. He said to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday in Washington. They are expected to issue a statement that calls for U.S. combat troops to leave Iraq by the end of the year. In January 2020, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of American forces. That followed the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer joining us out of Bali. Barry, welcome. Let's say American combat troops do leave Iraq. Will it make a difference on the ground? We have yet to see American combat troops engaging in combat with terrorists. They do attack Iraqi security forces, but not terrorists. So does this occupation, and when you hear that intelligence and training, U.S. American and intelligence and training forces are going to stay in Iraq, does this occupation have a different dimension other than military occupation?
Let's be clear about one thing. No one's leaving Iraq. In fact, the U.S. has been very clear. An official announced alongside of this showboating that the way the U.S. plans to meet its commitment of pulling back 2,500 ground troops, fighting troops, is to redefine the roles of troops already in Iraq rather than bringing anybody home. So nobody's leaving Iraq. That's the first point. The second point, this is really just another shell game. The fact of the matter is that the concern about U.S. forces in Iraq has almost never been about boots on the ground and conventional fighting forces so much as black operatives, the CIA, arming up people associated with ISIL, and other machinations taking place ostensibly to target Iran rather than the terrorists which the U.S. claimed to be in Iraq to fight. So this is all just public relations, and in fact, the U.S. has been quite open about that and said that the purpose of this statement is to give support to the foreign minister in responding to what the Americans are describing as extremist Shia elements in Iraq. And of course, they forget that Iraq is overwhelmingly Shiite rather than Sunni Muslim. Not that it really ultimately makes much difference, but what I will say is the fighting forces, the militia forces that are predominantly Shiite, have been a very important part of the official Iraq military response to ISIL. And those individuals taking part in it are no less Iraqi citizens than the Sunni participants. So this is all a whole lot of nonsense. The Americans have no intention to change anything. In fact, their most objectionable role in Iraq has been to run bombing sorties from the air and to weaponize the very people they claim to be there to fight.
Right, and Barry, you know, many would say that they're not Shia militias, they're integrated into Iraq's security forces by legislation, by Iraqi parliament's legislation, and that it's not Shia, the group that the U.S. claims to be targeting. It has more Sunni members than the Iraqi army has Sunni members, for example. But so in this case, are we going to anticipate an increase, an uptick in armed resistance by the Iraqi Iraqi forces against U.S. logistic convoys, against U.S. bases, who, according to them, they say they're protecting Iraq's national integrity and territorial integrity, preserving it?
Well, I would certainly hope so. Remember, in the aftermath of the U.S. Terrorist operation that killed General Soleimani, as well as some very important members of Iraq's militia movement, the Iraqi parliament directed the U.S. military to go home, to leave. And the U.S. position has been to drag its feet, to muddy the waters, to talk about negotiating withdrawal. And the best they've managed to come up with is this statement that they're going to reduce troops on the ground by 2,500, while at the same time saying they're not going to take anybody home, they're going to redefine roles. One would hope that those individuals, unfortunately, who are left carrying the heavy load in Iraq to fight for their country's future, will see the need to do whatever it is that's in their power under the leadership of the command structure and the Iraqi military to push the Americans in a way that they need to be pushed in order to go home with their tail tucked between their legs the same way they did in Vietnam.
Okay. Barry, thank you very much indeed. Barry Grossman there, international lawyer, joining us out of Bali. Now, Cuba has slammed new U.S. sanctions against the country over recent protests there. It says Washington has no authority to impose such measures.
The U.S. government has no legal, political, or moral authority whatsoever to sanction people around the world when it is known to engage in highly objectionable repressive behavior.
The minister said that there has been no act of repression against Cuban protesters. On Thursday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Cuba's defense minister and a special forces unit. It accused them of cracking down on protests earlier this month. President Joe Biden warned the sanctions were just the beginning of punitive measures against Havana. He said Washington is considering multiple new steps. Cuba saw protests over an ongoing economic crisis on July 11 and July 12. Havana blames the economic woes mainly on previous U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. Political commentator Danny Shaw says Washington has imposed more sanctions against Havana because it is fearful of the Cuban people's self-determination.
61 years of economic warfare, of diplomatic warfare is at fault. That is the context for tons of hardship that the 11 million people of Cuba endure daily? Who is Joe Biden in the U.S. government with so many human rights violations right here across the United States? Police brutality, an opioid heroin epidemic of unprecedented proportions, mental health crises that intensify every day. Who are they to impose more sanctions and more economic warfare on the beleaguered people of Cuba who've been resisting empire? And that's really their crime. These sanctions, this latest round, has nothing to do with human rights and everything to do with U.S. fear of Cuba as a shining example for the entire global South of self-determination.
Ecuador has declared a state of emergency in its penitentiary systems after riots at two prisons left 22 people dead.
The national government has taken immediate action. First, a state of emergency has been declared in the prison system in order to mobilize all the human and economic resources necessary to restore order. Military control has been established on the perimeter of access.
The president sent his condolences to the families of the victims who died in the prison riots. Lasso also expressed solidarity for a police officer who was raped amid the unrest. The president said she has the backing of justice to punish her attacker. Nearly 60 people, including 9 police officers, were injured in the Wednesday riots. The incidents took place at two of Ecuador's largest penitentiaries. The two facilities were also the scene of riots in February when nearly 80 inmates died in clashes between rival gangs. Turning to some coronavirus news now, Mexico has reported its highest daily rise in the number of new COVID-19 cases since the end of January, with over 16,000 infections. According to the country's health ministry, the total number of coronavirus cases has surpassed 2.7 million. Mexico has also registered 419 deaths in 24 hours. The total death toll is now at over 237,000. That's while the Mexican government says the real number of cases is likely significantly higher. Elsewhere in Latin America, Brazil has logged nearly 50,000 new infections and over 1,400 new fatalities, with a total death toll of over 500,000. The South American country suffers from the world's second deadliest COVID-19 outbreaks. The Australian state of New South Wales has tightened lockdown measures in its capital, Sydney, as the Delta variant of COVID-19 spreads fast over there. State officials say the lockdown set to end on July 30 may be extended further. They have called the situation in Sydney a national emergency. On Friday, New South Wales registered 136 new COVID cases. That's its biggest daily rise this year, driven by the Delta variant. The strain has caused the worst outbreak in Australia since the peak of the pandemic last year. The country has reported more than 1,900 infections since the first case was detected in Sydney in mid-June. That has also prompted curbs in other areas and put more than half of the country's population in lockdown. The president of the European Commission rejects Britain's demands to renegotiate the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol. Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc remains flexible within the protocol framework, but will not renegotiate it. She made the remarks after a Brit call with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Downing Street said Johnson told von der Leyen that the current form of the protocol is unsustainable and needs to undergo significant changes. Brussels and London agreed to the protocol in last year's Brexit deal to avoid enforcement of the EU's single market rules at the politically sensitive border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The EU has, however, been angered by the UK's move to unilaterally waive enforcement of some checks in the agreement. Protests have been held in Naples during a G20 ministerial meeting on environment, climate change and energy. Protesters say they have zero trust in the same politicians who have delivered a disastrous transformation of the global socio-economic system.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has nominated a panel for investigating crimes committed during Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. Former UN Rights Chief Navi Pillay will head the three-person commission of inquiry. The panel will investigate Israeli war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and also possible violations by Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Israel has opposed the probe and said it won't cooperate with the team. At least 250 Palestinians were killed and 13 Israelis died in the conflict that ended in a May 21st ceasefire. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet has said Israeli airstrikes on Gaza might constitute war crimes. Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
A Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding that he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Adam Gabbat. The piece is titled, Trump Supporter Sentenced to 8 Months in Prison for Role in Capitol Riot. Florida man was sentenced on Monday, 19th of July, to 8 months in prison for his role in the 6th of January insurrection in Washington, a punishment likely to set a benchmark for later cases. Paul Hodgkins from Tampa, Florida, pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding after he breached the U.S. Senate chamber during the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. Paul Hodgkins was filmed wearing a Trump 2020 T-shirt with a flag over his shoulder and eye goggles around his neck, and seen taking a selfie with a self-described shaman in a horned helmet and other rioters and the days behind him. He is the first rioter to be sentenced for a felony crime in connection with the attack, which saw hundreds of Trump supporters storm the Capitol building after they were fed lies about election fraud causing Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden. More than 570 people have been charged with taking part in the riot, during and after which five people died. Prosecutors had asked for Paul Hodgkins to serve 18 months, saying in a court filing he, like each rioter, contributed to the collective threat to democracy by forcing lawmakers to temporarily abandon their certification of Joe Biden's election victory and to scramble for shelter. Speaking in court in Washington, D.C. on Monday, 19th of July, Paul Hodgkins apologized and said he was ashamed of his behavior. Reading from a prepared text, he described being caught up in euphoria as he walked through Washington, then followed a crowd of hundreds up to Capitol Hill and into the Capitol building itself. If I had any idea that the protest would escalate the way it did, I would never have ventured further than the sidewalk of Pennsylvania Avenue, Hodgkins told the U.S. District Judge Randolph Moss. He added, "This was a foolish decision on my part." District Judge Randolph Moss said Hodgkins had actively and intentionally participated in an attack that threatened democracy itself, BuzzFeed reported. District Judge Randolph Moss also said Americans needed to be aware that assaulting the Capitol will have severe consequences. "The court here had to consider both what I think are extremely damaging events that occurred that day, but also who Mr. Hodgkins is as an individual," Judge Moss said. "And as I think is reflected by the sentencing I imposed, I tried to strike a balance." Hodgkins' sentence could influence other defendants as they decide whether to accept plea deals or go to trial. He and others are accused of serious crimes but were not indicted, as others were, for roles in larger conspiracies. Lawyer for Paul Hodgkins had asked District Judge Randolph Moss not to impose a prison sentence, saying the shame that would attach to Hodgkins for the rest of his life should be factored in. "Whatever punishment the court may provide will pale in comparison to the scarlet letter Mr. Hodgkins will wear for the rest of his life," Patrick N. LeDuc wrote in a court filing, citing a Nathaniel Hawthorne novel in which a woman accused of adultery is forced to wear the letter A. The filing argued that Hodgkins' conduct was not markedly different from those of Anna Morgan Lloyd, other than stepping onto the Senate floor. Anna Morgan Lloyd, a 49-year-old from Indiana, was the first of roughly 500 arrested to be sentenced. She pleaded guilty to misdemeanor, disorderly conduct, and last month was sentenced to 3 years probation. Hodgkins was not accused of assaulting anyone or damaging property. Prosecutors said he deserved some leniency for taking responsibility almost immediately and pleading guilty to obstruction, which carries a maximum 20-year prison sentence. But they also noted how he boarded a bus in his hometown of Tampa, Florida, bound for a Donald Trump rally, carrying rope, protective goggles, and latex gloves in a backpack, saying that showed he came to Washington prepared for violence. On 6th of January, he walked through grounds littered with smashed police barriers and broken windows, passing police officers and others injured as a crowd surged towards the Capitol building, prosecutors said. Time and time again, rather than turn around and retreat, Paul Hodgkins pressed forward, the government said. Some reacted with incredulity and outrage at what they saw as a lenient sentence and in some cases bias, especially compared with situations such as in Texas, where a black woman from Fort Worth, Crystal Mason, was sentenced to 5 years in prison after being convicted of illegally voting even though she didn't know she was ineligible to vote when she went to the polls in 2016. And another case of a Texan, Hervis Rogers, who now faces the possibility of a stiff sentence after being declared ineligible to vote because he was on parole and had waited in line for 7 hours.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In May, tensions in occupied Palestine escalated and the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This assault, as well as the threat of expulsion of Palestinians from occupied East Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which triggered Palestinian protests, are all just another chapter in the 73-year-old Palestinian Nakba. But these events demonstrate something very important: the failure of the normalization deals, the so-called Abraham Accords, or the deal of the century between four Arab countries and Israel, concluded in 2020. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in West Asia and reining in Israeli expansionist policies in Palestine. But as anticipated, they have proven to have failed in both. The announcement of the normalization of ties with Israel came laden with promises that it will help bring peace to Palestine, but it stopped the Israeli plan to annex parts of the occupied West Bank and supposedly opened the door to economic development for the entire region. But what has transpired since has proven that these agreements were a mere business transaction steered by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who did all he could to accommodate all of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's whims. The main outcome of the normalization deals is that the UAE is set to become a major trading partner for Israel after it abandoned the decades-old Arab boycott of Israel. Economic relations between Bahrain and Israel are also likely to intensify. Nothing for Sudan and Morocco, though, except the two countries are set to reap the benefits of their own small political wins facilitated by the U.S. easing its sanctions. None of these deals changed the situation on the ground in the region's hot spots, particularly in Palestine, as the events of the past few months demonstrate. Israel continues to be engaged in systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza. Past state laws that discriminate against non-Jews as they trample over Palestinians' religious rights and continue to threaten native Palestinians with forced expulsion from their homes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Oh.
Over the past few months, tensions in Palestine have escalated as the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This aggression, as well as the threat of displacing Palestinian natives from occupied East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which by the way triggered a lot of Palestinian protests, were a demonstration of the failure of the so-called normalization deals, or the deal of the century, between four Arab countries and Israel. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in the Middle East and reining in Israeli expansionist policies inside of Palestine, but they have proven to have failed in both. To discuss this issue with us from Madrid is Alberto Garcia Watson, journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Alberto, now the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians demonstrates that the normalization deals have basically just failed between these four Arab states and the Israeli entity. But why were these deals brokered then, if not for peace?
Because actually it was never intended to be for peace. It was actually expected that this last attack on Gaza was going to take place, and there were all the time threatenings with Gaza and the resistance groups with a major attack. So, however, this was a kind of distraction campaign to try to keep everyone distracted with the struggle for peace of the Americans and the Israelis. But it was never intended to be, it was never an intention of actually bringing peace to the region. As I said, it was just a distraction, and these countries unfortunately went for it. And they went for it because they were also bribed, because of, in the case of Morocco, it was the sovereignty of Morocco over the Occidental Sahara, which was a territory under the control of the Spaniards. When it comes to Sudan, were also different bribes given to that country, and also Bahrain, and we'll see other countries that will move in too. So it's actually never intended to bring peace to the region, and as I see very clearly, the intention of making out of Palestine a kind of an autonomous region under the control and the security of Israel will never be accepted by Palestinians.
Well, Alberto, Israel continued after the deals its engagement in Palestinian ethnic cleansing and in bringing out laws that discriminate against whoever is not Jew, and by discriminating also against the religious practices of Palestinians, whether they are Muslims or Christians. They even tried to displace people within the occupied Al-Quds Sharif. We have been seeing that since May in the occupied Sheikh Al-Jarrah neighborhood. One blockaded, carpet-bombed Gaza was able to stop them, was able to halt the Israeli expansionist plan and their aggression against the occupied territories. Will the sides involved in this deal be able to salvage what is left of it after what happened with Gaza?
What happened with Gaza was an attention that the resistance sent very clear after crossing the red lines that are Haram al-Sharif, the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that was desecrated by settlers and militaries, and the attempt on evacuating the population of Sheikh Jarrah, and what they're doing, for example, now with Silwan. Resistance made it very clear. There are red lines that Israelis cannot cross, and they learned under this last conflict with Gaza that basically the Israelis can not only have Mahmoud Abbas as a reference to deal with, but they're going to have to deal with the resistance, because everything is pointing at the power that the resistance now has will put Israel in its place. So that's why the deal of the century is never going to get through while the resistance is active, and the resistance has shown that they're going to rule from now on any opposition to the brutal occupation of the Israeli entity.
It was truly interesting, Alberto, to see Israeli far-right groups who feel emboldened by their electoral alliance with the new Prime Minister Bennett, who also stepped up harassment against the Palestinians, if I may. Some of them marched in Jerusalem a couple of weeks back, and they were chanting death to Arabs, and the entire world was watching them. But how do you think the latest Palestinian revolt whether in Al-Quds or in the occupied West Bank, will maybe further affect the scene inside the Palestinian territories, especially after the assassination of a very prominent activist like Nizar Banat and the arrest of several others?
Well, what we saw that day, the day that the Israelis called the Day of the Flag in Jerusalem, it was not just assassinate and kill the Arabs. There were some groups that even went as far as chanting, tonight we're not Jews, tonight we are Nazis. That far they got. And this provocation that actually was allowed even by the Israeli authorities gave very much the knowledge of what is the mentality of the new government that is basically created by different groups of radicals, especially extreme radical Jews that are in this government, and that are trying to see how far they can get and how far can the Palestinians take it. What happened also with the Nizar Banat, the killing of Nizar Banat by the Palestinian National Authority, because of denouncing the collaborationism of Abbas with Israelis, it's putting a lot of Palestinians today in the territories, especially in Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, against the president Mahmoud Abbas, that there shouldn't even be a president at this point, because it's already years ago that he should have been out of power.
Well, after the victories, Alberto, of the Al-Quds sword operation, all allied forces of the resistance in the region, going from Beirut to Damascus to Baghdad to Tehran to Sana'a, they all voiced their support and their readiness to engage in order to support and fight back the Zionist entity from Al-Quds al-Sharif. How viable do you think this new equation in reality is?
Well, the new equation, if you let me share a fact with you, is that in the last year, 50,000 Israelis have left Israel. And they have asked for dual citizenship, especially in Europe and the United States and Russia and other countries, because the big dream of the Zionists was actually to find a home, a national home for the Jews that were prosecuted around the world, and a place where they could feel secure. Today, Israelis do not feel secure anymore. Today, the Israelis are starting to feel what many Palestinians have been suffering for the past seven decades. And it's terror and it's fear. It's no stability in the country, and it's definitely no security. And this is one of the achievements of the resistance, and is that the fear has changed sides.
I want to thank you very much, Alberto Garcia-Watson, journalist and political commentator, for joining us to talk about the failure of the deal of the century, especially after the latest Israeli assault on Gaza and the occupied internal Palestinian territories. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. continues to demonize the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The demonization of Iran is now a well-established reality of American contemporary politics. It's a clear mistake, yet the U.S. continues to trap itself in a perpetual Middle East conflict. Over the past 42 years, the U.S. decided that Iran needs to be classified as an evil power. That inclination makes it very difficult for the American regime to come to a resound understanding of how they got so deeply tangled in the Persian Gulf and how it is that they would end up basically in the pocket of the Saudis. Maybe it's about time the U.S. acted reasonable to at least acknowledge that Iran has its own security interests and will not allow anyone to tamper with it. More in the following report.
Imagine an Iranian drone had been shot down over Florida or just off its coast. Rather than arguing about its exact position, we would surely be shocked at its presence almost 7,000 miles from Iran. But on June 20, 2019, Iran downed a U.S. drone that had violated its airspace, and almost nobody asked if the U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf was even justified. It is truly appalling how the U.S. regime does not fathom that the current escalation between the United States and Iran, presenting Iran as a threat, nuclear or otherwise, over and over again, carries the clear message that it must be confronted. It's much more accurate to say that the U.S. is a threat to Iran than the opposite. After all, it's the U.S. government that is destroying Iran's economy through sanctions that limit Iranians' access to food and medicine while surrounding Iran with military bases and land, sea, and air forces. Iran has done nothing remotely comparable as opposed to the constant U.S. warmongering hegemony. This inversion of reality, which favors U.S. military might, is strengthened by selective political memory and by the media's lies of omission. Who in the West remembers Iran Air Flight 655? On July 3, 1988, the USS Vincennes, patrolling in Iranian territorial waters, downed an airliner with 290 civilian passengers en route for Dubai. The United States initially denied responsibility, then claimed that the Vincennes was in international waters and that the Airbus, which it had mistaken for a fighter jet, was descending toward it in a threatening manner. The United States later admitted that both statements were untrue. And just like that, Flight 655 was soon forgotten in the media, except in Iran. American News Business works on hating Iran and promoting the latest lies of the Pentagon to attain or maintain a position of authority in the U.S. The demonization of Iran is truly the most bizarre and self-defeating of all U.S. foreign policies. Americans view Iran not simply as a country with interests that sometimes conflict with their own, but as a relentless font of evil. American politicians rarely speak that way about any other country. Iran occupies a unique place in U.S. pantheon of enemies simply because the Islamic Republic of Iran is a sovereign nation. Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you very much for being with us, Patrick. Now, the demonization of Iran is now a very well-established reality in U.S. contemporary politics, just as once Vietnam and Afghanistan were, despite the fact that the U.S. engaged in war with them and came out defeated. Shouldn't that be lesson number one for them to change completely their foreign policy with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Unfortunately, successive U.S. administrations haven't really looked to history for any of these sort of lessons. At the moment, the U.S., Washington, is just generally still in denial of its own debacles, denial of just, you know, how things have developed in the region and how things have moved forward since 2003. It's a very different Middle East than it was when the U.S. bombed and invaded Iraq. A new arc of resistance has formed, and it's formed as a direct result of Western interventions. And probably one of the biggest factors of that right now would be what's happened in Syria over the last decade. Now it's 10 years really since that proxy war has been prosecuted against Syria and its allies, and Iran is front and center in that conflict. It's come to the aid of its allies in Syria. What it wants is stability in the region. It doesn't want to see another state, certainly not an ally, be dismembered by foreign countries that are ganging up, as it were, on Syria. The same thing has happened in Yemen as well. So, you know, you can look at it from that point of view. Certainly the U.S. rushes to protect its allies and reserves that as its sovereign right as a nation state to act in its interest, its national or geopolitical interest, or in self-defense.
Patrick, we did see the U.S. attacking Syria and Iraq several times, and every time it did so, it cited that it was targeting so-called Iranian mercenaries or Iranian militias, despite the fact that it was Syrian Arab army who were being murdered and Iraqi fighters who were also being martyred by these strikes. How come the American public does not even question the sustainability of such attacks or even question what the U.S. is doing there, despite the fact that it will backfire on their boys and girls, daughters and sons in the U.S. Army in those military bases in those regions?
In general, the American public has no idea what's happened, let alone any of these recent airstrikes or anything really of the last few years for that matter. Why and what the implications are going forward, because that's the important thing. What are the implications of these airstrikes? And it's really just pulling the United States further and further down a rabbit hole that it really doesn't have any plan how to navigate, let alone get out of going forward. So effectively, U.S. forces are really mercenary forces right now. And whose interests are they really defending, specifically when we're talking about the Syrian-Iraqi border? They're really defending the interests, strategic interests, of Israel or of the Gulf states. So defending their strategic interests, not the U.S.'s per se. Mm-hmm. And so the Hashd-e Shaabi, the People's Mobilization Units, they're constantly mischaracterized in the U.S. or in the West as Iranian-backed militias, and they actually fall under the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. They are effectively part of the Iraqi armed forces, and they've done all the heavy lifting in the fight against ISIS on the ground. And they really defeated ISIS from that effort in around October of 2017. You could say they could declare victory over ISIS at that time, but that's completely expunged from the record in the Western media, in the narratives that are running through politics and media in the West, and hence nobody really understands A, why they're there, what's happening there, and how to get out gracefully.
Just a regular policy of omitting news from U.S. media, but the U.S. Regime has a narrative that describes U.S.-Iranian relations that dates back to the hostage situation of the late 70s. Now, the U.S. narrative doesn't include anything that happened before that, not even the CIA's overthrow of Iranian President Mossadegh back in early 1950s. What would it really take to change this hegemonic approach of the U.S. consecutive U.S. administrations against the Islamic Republic of Iran? Is it basically war what they want? Is it just in reality? Do they want a confrontation with Iran?
It's a very difficult position, a very difficult phase of this situation right now. You could say a war from a Western perspective is going to underline and define the paradigm going forward. So they're in a kind of a limbo at the moment in terms of their purpose. Okay, but it will take a major embarrassment or a major defeat. I mean, the United States' position is very weak in Iraq, per se, right now. And just generally, it's very weak in the region. I mean, the missile attacks on Al-Nasad Air Base and in Erbil in January of 2020, that should have really sent a message to Washington as to how weak their position is, pulling out of Qatar, the major U.S. equipment, forces, and so forth, relocating, rearranging the pieces on the chessboard. So will it take a Saigon moment? In Iraq, certainly that's, we're having a view of what that might look like in Afghanistan right now. Mm-hmm. This could be the same situation in Iraq when you've overstayed your time there. And certainly I think they have. They're trying to get leverage right now for the Iran nuclear deal. That seems to be all that's left on the table for the U.S. or to renegotiate the missile treaty internationally with Russia, throw Iran in the mix mm-hmm. there, and then walk away with some kind of a victory there. But again, it's really down to what Israel wants when you're talking about Washington.
Well, the U.S. can claim the prerogative of waging war against whoever it wants, just like George W. Bush, who implemented the claim by invading Iraq in 2003, and he put a list of West Asian countries that he wants to go after one after the other, and we did see how that was going on over the past 12 to 15 years. Do the Americans really believe that such states will hear that and wait there for the war to happen? I mean, least that Iran could do is put forth a strategic plan to defend itself, its interests, its perimeter. When will the U.S. regime just hold its horses and realize that there is no longer a unipolar political world out there?
Yeah, and it's not only that in terms of the polarization that exists. One of the main reasons is because of its sort of a blanket policy of sanctions against multiple countries right now in the Middle East. You're looking at Syria, Iran, also Yemen as well. So sanctions is an act of war. That's just going to permanently polarize the situation in the region as well. But, you know, this take the JCPOA, for instance, that began to degrade under President Obama because the U.S. did not adhere to its commitments with the Iran nuclear deal, much like the Trump administration, who basically backed out of it and really finalized it, something that was already collapsing. So the U.S. and the EU did not even bother to honor their international commitments on this. So that was, I believe, a fatal mistake, which I think is triggering what looks like a slow-motion collapse in U.S. hegemony right now. So this degraded status will eventually reverberate to its Israeli allies, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the rest of the Gulf as well. This is already happening as we speak. So, and again, it's just because the U.S.'s position and its allies is absolutely untenable, as are the policies. And I think the world at large is beginning to see this as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for joining us from London to discuss this issue with us. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime secretly authorized a group of cyber surveillance firms to work for Saudi Arabia, despite international condemnation of the kingdom's abuse of surveillance software to crush dissent, even after the Saudi killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written jointly by Ronan Bergman and Mark Mazzetti, journalists. This article is published under the heading Zionist Regime Companies Aided Saudi Spying Despite Khashoggi Killing. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime secretly authorized a group of cyber surveillance firms to work for Saudi Arabia regime, despite international condemnation of the kingdom's abuse of surveillance software to crush dissent, even after the Saudi killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Zionist regime encouraged NSO and two other companies to continue working with Saudi Arabia and issued a new license for a fourth to do similar work, overriding any concerns about human rights abuses. Since then, Saudi Arabia has continued to use the spyware to monitor dissidents and political opponents. The fact that the Zionist regime has encouraged its private companies to do security work for the kingdom is yet more evidence of the reordering of traditional alliances in the region and the strategy by the Israeli regime and several Persian Gulf countries to join forces. NSO is by far the best known of the Israeli regime firms, largely because of revelations in the last few years that its Pegasus program was used by numerous regimes to spy on and eventually imprison human rights activists. NSO sold Pegasus to Saudi Arabia regime in 2017. The kingdom used the spyware as part of a ruthless campaign to crush dissent inside the kingdom and to hunt down Saudi dissidents abroad. It is not publicly known whether Saudi Arabia used Pegasus or other Israeli regime-made spyware in the plot to kill Khashoggi. NSO has denied that its software was used.
The Zionist regime's Ministry of War also licensed for Saudi work a company called Candiro, which Microsoft accused last week of helping its regime clients spy on more than 100 journalists, politicians, dissidents, and human rights advocates around the world. Microsoft, which conducted its investigation in tandem with Citizen Lab, a research institute at the University of Cereno, said Candiro had used malware to exploit a vulnerability in Microsoft products, enabling its regime clients to spy on perceived enemies. Candiro has had at least one contract with Saudi Arabia regime since 2018. The Zionist regime has also granted licenses to at least two other firms. Variant, which was licensed before the Khashoggi killing, the Quadrim, which signed a contract with Saudi Arabia after the killing. A fifth company, Celebrite, which manufactures physical hacking systems for mobile phones, has also sold its services to the Saudi regime, but without ministry approval, according to the newspaper